Hey,
how's it going, guys? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show.
Is this thing on or what?
Thanks very much for tuning in. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I'm against it. Always. And the point is to try to get you to be against it too. Not that I need or would be willing to lie in order to convince you. The simple truth is argument enough, I have found. Today on the show, Jeremy Keenan is going to be back on the show. Now, this is one of those things where there's a hole in my brain where something important should be, and I got no excuse. I interviewed this guy before, all about the war in Mali. And then I never interviewed him again. I completely forgot he existed. But then Martha Mundy, who I interviewed about Yemen, sent me a link to an article by him about Mali, you know, in Western Africa, M-A-L-I. And I thought, man, this guy's name sounds familiar. I Googled him up, and there he is on my website, because I interviewed him 2 years ago and hadn't given a second thought since, unfortunately, for you and for me and for everyone. But here's a guy who really knows about Mali a lot, and he can tell you, and he's going to tell us. It's consequences of American foreign policy. Absolutely. So, that's going to be great. And then also Dan Sanchez is going to be back on the show from the Mises Institute and antiwar.com and anti-media. And he's going to be talking about the Paris attack and the lessons he's drawn from it. I hope you'll listen to him. Good old Dan Sanchez. Now, here's my thing. Did you see this? Islamic Center of Pflugerville vandalized with feces. Pflugerville, that's a suburb of Austin, basically. Used to be a town. It's a small town in a way. At its core, it's still a small town northeast of Austin, Texas. P.F. Pflugerville. Why is it spelled like that? Well, because it's somebody's last name from a long time ago, probably, right? I don't know. Pflugerville. Nice little place, not far at all from here. And, you know, thank goodness nobody was hurt. Kind of minor vandalism. Nothing that bucket of bleach water can't cure, you know, as far as actual real harm goes. I mean, you know, the literal harm. But somebody, apparently in my community, thought that it would be a good idea, even on a somewhat lower level, to try to terrorize Muslims and to try to make them fear assembling in order to practice their religion. To exercise it, in the words of the Bill of Rights and its First Amendment ban on any government intervention in that area. And I think that it's probably just a mathematical fact, right? That, you know, somebody threw some dog mess at their door, whatever it was, that, you know, even though that's not the very worst thing that could happen, that some people in the community are going to be afraid to go there now. They're now wondering what's going to happen next. Is somebody going to shoot them? Just for being Muslim? Just for showing up? And of course, if you're dumb enough to believe that Islam makes people attack things that are good and innocent, and that that is the root of our terror war, then I guess you'd be dumb enough to go and take it out on your own neighbors, who obviously have nothing to do with anything going on here. And anyway, I think it sucks. I tried to call him to get him on the show. I guess they're doing more important interviews. I hope that's why they didn't answer. I left a voicemail. Maybe I'll get him on tomorrow. But the thing of it is, man, just look at the terrorists. I was just reading a profile of one of the leaders of the attack in Paris, who is from Belgium, who everyone says that even to this day, he's not an especially religious guy. Radical Islam isn't his thing. Yeah, he's a Muslim. He identifies himself as a fellow Muslim of other Muslims. But he doesn't subscribe to, or didn't, or whatever, subscribe to the most extreme type beliefs. And he didn't believe in them in the most extreme type ways either. And all of his quotes seem to be about the bloodletting at the hands of the Americans and their Western allies. Funny about that. It's almost like that time a bunch of Christians joined up the army, not because Jesus told them to kill all the Muslims, but because some Muslims had attacked the United States. They went to go join up to go and, who do I kill? Same damn difference. The terrorists, they have the exact morals of the Republicans and the Democrats. That's why they're so evil. They're willing to kill innocent people to get their work done. And, you know, yesterday on the show I was talking a little bit about a friend of mine's mom from way, way back. I haven't seen in forever, but who's a nice, just regular lady, somebody's secretary or something, you know. Who's ready to just kill them all? Who says, nah, it's just, meh, I don't know. She can't imagine any solution other than kill every Arab until they're all dead, and then we won't have to worry about them anymore. Because whoever heard of a better solution than that? I mean, everybody knows it's their religion that makes them do it. You look at their vicious attacks, all they ever do is kill innocent people. And they only do it because apparently they're evil nihilists who just are murderers. They got no strategy, no tactics, no politics to understand. Hell, I can't even understand a word they say when they're talking that crazy Arab language. Can you? And so, one thing I know is we got the daisy cutters. The nukes, if it comes down to it. That's what people believe, man. That's what our government, that's the position our government has put Americans in. Because they just won't tell the truth. The only one of them who ever told the truth was Ron Paul. And, you know, he did make a huge impression on millions of people when he beat Giuliani's ass on the question of blowback. But on the other hand, he didn't really win over the American narrative. He did not win that fight ultimately in the political conversation in the United States of America. And they don't. Often, Rubio is the only one in recent memory who said, they hate us because we're free and they hate us because we let women drive and whatever. I think it's been since McCain that somebody tried to say that in such a blatant, kind of cartoonish sort of way. And it always falls real flat. Now, I think everybody pretty much knows that's not true. Or at least, you know, it's less certain than before or something. I don't know. But they're getting away with acting as though it's still some established fact that they hate us because we're free. When in fact, they hate us because of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama's horrible policies, which include mass murder of now counting millions of people over the last 25 years. That's why. Come on. You knew that. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I try to be nice and optimistic and, you know, pro-human and that kind of thing. I like to believe that armed with reason, most adults will choose right. I like to believe that, you know, conservatives are trying at their core to conserve what's best about America. At their core, liberals believe in liberty somewhere in there. I don't know. And I know that's really less than half true on both sides, but trying to accentuate the positive, I guess I don't do a very good job of it, but you know, Donald Trump is saying, hey, maybe we need to start looking into closing down mosques. And I think that's probably good politics. I think that might actually help him secure the nomination. Purge the enemy within. You know, conservatives, man, they're just not happy if they're not terrified. And, you know, going to the drive-in movie just ain't going to cut it. They have to believe that they're all about to be crucified at any moment for whatever, you know, persecution nonsense. Even though the vast supermajority of Americans identify themselves as Christians, left and right. But anyway, people just, I don't know how much respect. It's supposed to go without saying that everyone in America's highest principle is that they believe in everybody else's right to believe in whatever religion they want. That's the whole point of living between Canada and Mexico. You can believe whatever you want. Numero uno. Principle one. You own yourself, including your mind and your heart. And if you don't want other people telling you how to believe in or practice your faith, then you just are going to have to provide that same kind of tolerance to everybody else. That, if there's a social contract in America, that's it. And yet people are happy to say, no, there ought to be a prayer in school. This is one that goes back forever, right? The government schools. Which version of the Lord's Prayer should we have in government school? And it's always the Baptists going, yeah, we want prayer in school right now. And then they always go, oh, wait a minute, and they realize there are way more Methodists than Baptists, and they're going to make your little Baptist kid do a Methodist prayer. And then how are you going to like that? And then all of a sudden, no, no, dude, they get two words wrong in their prayer or whatever the discrepancy is there. Trespass goes before the comma, not after the comma. And all of a sudden, war. You'd think that they'd join forces against the terrible secular humanists, but no. And anyway, this is the kind of stupid argument that no one in America should ever have to even make. People trashing each other's, well, not even each other's, American right-wing Christians attacking and persecuting Muslims just for being Muslim. You know, this Islamic Center in Pflugerville, as far as we know, they're Sufis. As far as we know, they're Shia. As far as we know, they've done nothing but denounce Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State every day since 2001. As far as we know, they teach the glory of the American Bill of Rights and the Statue of Liberty and baseball at every Friday prayer. But, oh yeah, I heard that you think that there was another prophet after the one that I believe in. Well, put up your dukes then. No human rights for you then. No respect for you. That's what's wrong with America, is we're not the old world, right, everybody? Let's forget everything we ever got right about living here. Like that movie, Jesus Camp. You ever see Jesus Camp, where they're all worshiping George W. Bush? And praying at a cardboard cutout of him? And the teacher lady saying, yeah, you know, you're reading the news about Pakistan and how everybody over there is killing each other over religion stuff. That's how I want to live. That's showing true devotion to your religion. Yeah, well, move to Pakistan then, lady. And leave the rest of us out of it. Pakistan, where they kill people for converting to Christianity. She wants to go and fight about that. She wants to stay here so that we can fight about that. So we can have a 30 years war in America between every different sect of Protestantism and Catholicism. And then I guess that's after the war against everybody who's not a Christian. What fun. Yeah, that's way better than, you know, having your family and prosperity and your health, your weekend time. Yeah, I would way rather die in a war over whose prophet is whose, for God's sake. Anyway, I'm being a bit hyperbolic, because it is still just a poo flinging at this point, but we've seen worse. And of course, it's always the Sikhs who get it. And the Sikhs, why? Because they have the bigger, more obvious turbans. But they're not even Muslims. Or I think maybe they're some very, you know, second religion twice removed from Islam type faith from east of Pakistan. But the bigger the turban, the bigger the target for the biggest dipshits in the Republican Party, you know, and their rank and file, I might add. It ain't libertarians and it ain't liberals attacking people for having the wrong faith. It's the conservatives. Anyway. You know, there's something else great that I was going to say, but then I should have written it down because I can't remember what it was. But oh well, don't worry, because coming up, we're going to have two great interviews. Jeremy Keenan on Mali, and then Dan Sanchez on France and Syria, and all of that, and there is a lot of it. Right now, for a little parentheses, I'll just throw in, brand new Nick Terse hit at Tom Dispatch today, and he is the author of the book, Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. If you go to tomdispatch.com, you can get one if you donate to them. But you can also read this great article. Everything by Terse is just great. He is the guy on American intervention in Africa. This one is called Does 11 Plus 1 Equal 60? AFRICOM's New Math. That's at tomdispatch.com. Right back. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. As often happens, my friend Bill in the email has sent a correction. Interesting article here. The Sikhs are neither Hindu nor Muslim. And it's a great article. Apparently they are monotheists, although not necessarily the exact same one god as the other monotheists. But anyway, very interesting little article here. You could just Google that up. The Sikhs are neither Hindus nor Muslims, which is what I thought at first, but then I thought I'd been corrected a bit on that, but apparently now I've been corrected back again. Anyway, there you go. And point being, they always get targeted in anti-Muslim hate crimes in America just because of their hats, when they're not even Muslims at all. Not that being Muslim would make them collectively guilty of anything anyway, but we're talking about right-wing idiots, so what are you going to do? All right, now on to our first guest today. It's Jeremy Keenan, and very importantly, he writes for Middle East Eye. He is a professor. He is a professorial research associate at the School of Oriental and Africa Studies at the University of London. He's written many books, including The Dark Sahara and The Dying Sahara. And is a consultant to the UN and the European Commission, etc., like that. His most recent article at Middle East Eye is called Mali, a Peace Deal to Promote Conflict. Welcome back to the show, Jeremy. How are you doing?
Hello, Scott. Very good. I was going to say good evening, but it's actually good morning with you, is it not?
Yeah, it'll be lunchtime here in about half an hour.
Wonderful.
I'm on Texas time. But yeah, good evening to you, sir. Yeah. Very good to have you back on the show, and I'm kind of kicking myself that we haven't been keeping up all this time. You know, when I go back through your archives here and look at, you know, this obviously extensive knowledge that you have of Mali, the conflict and the background and everything. So I guess before we get to the peace deal, let's talk a little bit about the war deal. Start in 2011 or before that?
Sorry, which deal?
The war deal. What happened? What happened that started the most recent conflict? And then we can get to what's so bad about the peace agreement.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one can take the start of the conflict back and back and back in history. But
sure.
I suppose the best time to start is really with the fall of Gaddafi. With the fall of Gaddafi, or the overthrow of Gaddafi, mm-hmm. a lot of Tuareg who had gone up into Libya looking for work, some of them as mercenaries, but most of them just emigrating out of the Sahel region, that's out of Mali and out of Niger, because there's of drought, lack of employment, lack of money. So they'd gone up to Libya. And a lot of them came back. We're talking about maybe, certainly many hundreds, possibly 2,000 or 3,000. I mean, that sort of number. So they came back into Niger and into Mali. Those in Niger, the problem of coming back home was sort of resolved, but in Mali it wasn't. There had been a rebellion, a Tuareg rebellion against the government, both in Niger and in Mali, running through about 2008, 2009, 2010, and it had never really been resolved, but it had sort of died down through exhaustion more than anything else. But these guys came back. They came back with a lot of arms. They were very angry. They were angry with everybody, with the West for overthrowing Gaddafi, with everybody because of their circumstance. And when they got back into Mali, the Mali government, which is down in Bamako, which is a good sort of 1,000 miles away from the northern part of Mali where the Tuareg come from. They paid very little attention to them. They paid very little attention to their grievances. And that really sparked off a renovation, if you like, of the rebellion. So this is at the end of 2011, October, November, December. And by January 2012, they had taken up arms. And very quickly, they had overrun northern Mali. But also very quickly, their movement, this is the Tuareg rebel movement, had been hijacked by a so-called Islamist movement or groups of Islamists which were in fact being supported and supplied by Algeria from the north, which has never been made sort of very public, largely to weaken the Tuareg movement because that was a threat to Algeria as well. So we get an awful mess developing in northern Mali, and by the middle of 2012, the whole of northern Mali is effectively in the hands of jihadists, that's Islamist jihadists, rather than the Tuareg rebels who had been almost sidelined. And that sort of reaches a stalemate. But then by the end of 2012, the Islamists start to break out further south, threatening towards the capital, and with the UN and other parties sort of really faffing around, not really knowing what to do, France decides to move in with a military intervention. This is in January now, 2013. They very quickly pushed the Islamists back up into the north, killed off several hundred, but certainly didn't overcome the problem. In fact, the security situation isn't much better now than it was then. That really led on to the whole question of some sort of peace agreement, which has been going on really since then. But two or three months ago, starting in May, then again in June, July, a peace agreement of sorts was signed by most of the parties. I say that very reluctantly because if you took it to an international court, it probably wouldn't stand up for very long, largely because the amount of sort of coercion on some of the parties. Most of the Tuareg claimed they had no say in the peace treaty at all. There's some truth in that. So it was a bit of a coerced peace agreement, if you like. And that didn't really last for very long. More fighting continued. This is now through August, September, October, really up to about a month ago. Now between really a very complex ethnic mix, but to put it a bit simply, two different Tuareg groups. So you're now getting fighting between the populations in the northern regions, two Tuareg, I won't call them tribes, that's a bit simplistic, but two Tuareg classes, if you like, a traditionally a more superior, a lower class in a sort of African traditional culture. They start fighting, one sort of being supported by the government, the one against the government. That got very, very messy. So we're getting a continuation of fighting, but almost, you know, you can imagine the groups involved in the fighting sort of, changing, if you like, as time moves on. In short, there's been really, since 2011, and before that, 3 years of rebellion, but since the overthrow of Gaddafi, we get this renewed rebellion in the north, taking on this very complex mix, first of all with the Islamists coming in, then in internal divisions between the fighters themselves, and that takes us up to pretty well where we are now. And at this particular moment, probably over the last 2 or 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe the most optimistic signs out of a very pessimistic situation are just beginning to emerge. So right now, we might just be sort of looking at slightly better scenario, but from a very wretched base, if you like. Mm-hmm.
And which are those latest developments?
Well, I suppose there's been an agreement which was reached with the intervention of UN peacekeepers, various other international bodies, about a month ago between these two, I call them Tuareg factions, Tuareg groups who were fighting. One group was being backed by the government and a lot of other fairly nasty militia. So it was a pretty nasty bunch. They were fighting predominantly the old Tuareg rebels, without getting more complex. So if you like, two Tuareg groups. And that fighting had got pretty nasty. It came to an end about a month ago, roughly. Frankly, more as a result of exhaustion. And this is kind of an interesting scenario. If you go back over...
Actually, hold it right there, Jeremy. We got to take this break now.
Okay.
And then when we get back, we'll hear about the peace deal, what could be in it, what should be in it, and it sounds like some optimistic signs, even if, for kind of negative reasons, as you said, they just killed each other out and are tired now. But anyway, everybody hang tight. We'll be right back with Jeremy Keenan. Oh, I've been saying Keegan this whole time too, I think. I'm so sorry. Jeremy Keenan from Middle East Eye. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Jeremy, again, I'm sorry if I've been saying Keegan. There's another guest I've been interviewing lately named Keegan, and it's Keenan, everyone. K-E-E-N-A-N, Keenan, Jeremy Keenan at Middle East Eye. And we're talking about the war in Mali. And so it's this funny-shaped country, right, where this gigantic Texas-sized north of the country, which is populated mostly by the Tuaregs, is dominated by, I guess, if we go way back in history, the French-supported minority, or I don't know the numbers, but the French-supported smaller land area in the south where the people who have had the power this time, I guess, under the French, are blacks from a different ethnicity and a different culture and background than the people that they've ruled in the north. So Jeremy was telling the story of how after the Libya war, a lot of the Tuaregs came home to northern Mali after being on the losing Gaddafi side. And they had a bunch of guns and started saying, hey, you know, autonomy is one thing, but independence is better. And then how Algeria sent the jihadists, many of them came from Libya, obviously, to come and sideline, as Jeremy said, the Tuaregs, and take the war all the way down to the south, at which point the French finally intervened and went and backed up the government in the south and kicked the invading jihadists out and back up to the north and all that. Now, one of the things I wanted to go over here with you was how before the French intervened, I guess it would have been in the fall of 2012, Hillary Clinton took a trip to Algeria to ask them to do something about the jihadists in northern Mali that you're telling me the Algerians, you know, that the Algerians were actually in cahoots with at the time. So I'm just wondering, I mean, this is the same Hillary Clinton who was in cahoots with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia in Libya. So who knows? But do you think she was just being deceived there, or she just had no idea what the hell was going on with this war at the time?
Well, I don't want to get involved in Hillary's problems or not. Is the case, or,
well, I mean, if you remember that visit, I mean, did that seem confusing to you? Like, what is she doing?
You've just reminded me of it. The point here is that the whether Hillary knew about this or not, I have absolutely no idea. But the point is that the Algerian Secret Service did work very closely with the American intelligence services, extremely closely, and they have done all through the so-called War on Terror. And the Algerian Secret Services, which was known by American intelligence, were supporting many of these Islamist groups. I can't really say much more than that because that pretty well sums it up. Whether Hillary knew that or not, I don't know. But
well, then you assume it's the case then, or it seems obvious it's the case that Algeria was working with the Americans then in supporting these jihadists in northern Mali just as well as in Libya before?
Well, I'd be a little bit careful with the words there. It's
okay.
Like a triangulation. America was working with the Algerian Secret Services. Okay, that's one connection. The Algerian Secret Services, they were working with the various, call them jihadi groups, in the region, which they had been for a long time. when I say working with them, they had infiltrated a lot of them. They had some control over the leadership. There was a few false flag operations. They supplied weaponry to these movements in northern Mali, etc. So you've got two connections there. Making a triangle out of it is a little bit tenuous, because although people within the American intelligence services did know about that relationship between the Algerian secret services and the jihadists, I have no idea whether it would have gone across to Hillary's side of things in State Department, whether she would have been aware of it. She would certainly know from her own experience as Foreign Secretary that Algeria does carry an awful lot of stick in the region. Let's put it that way. Algeria is a major power. It has influence. It has, so she would certainly know that by asking the Algerians to exercise some clout in the region, that would be possible. But, you know, I don't want to say, because I don't know, whether she was aware of the linkage between the Algerian secret services and the jihadi movements.
Mm-hmm. And now, so what would you say is the power of the jihadist movements in northern Mali now? I mean, we are talking about a huge land area there for them to at least hide in,
area.
Right?
Numerically, they are very much smaller. There's no question about that. You know, we're down now to talking about a couple of groups, a few dozen here and there. But active, they're causing quite a lot of trouble, particularly in the central Mali region. They're offshoots of the group that was operating there, you know, at the time we were talking about, just a couple of years ago. They're still, you know, fairly small groups. They're causing problems. They're hitting the odd police post every now and again. There's probably about an incident every, on average, every 2 or 3 weeks, perhaps. There have been a couple that have crossed over into the border, going further south into Burkina Faso and the Cote d'Ivoire border. So the jihadi elements in the country are still fairly problematic, let's put it that way, but they are infinitely less powerful and numerous than they were when France moved in a couple of years ago and pushed them back out. Because when it pushed them out, a lot of them went north up into Tunisia, more went over into Libya. So they kicked the problem down the road, you know, to use an expression, which is really what they did. Mm-hmm. And that problem has become quite serious, of course, in other parts of the Sahara now, Libya, in Niger, and across into Chad. And Mali is sort of left, but, you know, with a residual, quite an active, you know, jihadi sort of problem.
Mm-hmm.
But not as big as it was a couple of years ago.
And so the Tuaregs are basically back in charge in northern Mali then, for the most part.
Well,
or no?
Let's put it this way. The government has not reestablished itself in any real sense or form, that is a military presence or anything else, in the northern region of Kidal. Kidal, that's K-I-D-A-L, that's the northern region, which is the predominantly Tuareg region. That is still pretty much in Tuareg sort of hands, with a United Nations, a peacekeeping force up in the area. So this new peace agreement, you know, there's still the big question of how is that region going to be sort of reintegrated back into the country. This all has to be worked out. I mean, the peace deal is still very much up in the sky. Mm-hmm. The actual implementation of it has a long way to go. It's not going to be easy. I'd be very surprised if it doesn't result in further outbreaks of skirmishing here and there, maybe a bit of fighting. I'm not optimistic, really, for the future. Although the present situation is a little bit more optimistic, you know, today than it has been over the last year or two. But it's going to be a lot of uphill struggle, and a lot will depend not so much on the Mali government, which is really not very well trusted and not very competent at all, but on the international community. Which hasn't really excelled itself so far, but it has the opportunity to do so now, let's put it that way. And there is an awful lot of money waiting in the wings. There's $3 to $4 billion equivalent of pledged money. That means it probably won't all get there, but there's an awful lot of money from the international community available for the redevelopment of the north, but big questions about, you know, corruption, accountability, all these sort of things. So, you know, those are problems that have to be surmounted.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, and you mentioned the war spreading to Niger and Chad, and I believe it was Chad where I read they were putting in the new drone base there. Maybe it was both. I can't imagine that's really helping, although that's supposedly the purpose of putting them there is to help. But can you talk a little bit more about the spreading of the war there to the neighboring states?
The war has spread sort of eastwards, if you like, sort of from Mali through Niger. When I say the war, the presence of so-called terrorist groups, Islamist groups, numerically not very big, but and in fact, there's very little information on what is going on there. But what has happened is the French military have moved into the region with a military operation which is called Barkhane, Operation Barkhane. That's 3,000 troops. It's actually probably nearer to 4,000 or 5,000 troops stationed through Niger, Chad, a little bit of support from Americans, but very much in the back room, so to speak. About 30 trainers went to a place called Agadez this last week with the drone base, as you say, and the French have got drones there as well. There is a more direct correlation between this expansion of Western military forces across the region and the increasing insecurity in the region, which often happens, as we've seen in many other parts of the world where there have been interventions of this sort.
This entire story is just one intervention causing the other and the other and the other all the way down.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of those big problems is that Boko Haram, which was located very much in northern Nigeria, they are spreading north. So you're getting Boko Haram moving out of northern Nigeria, possibly being pushed by the Nigerian army, which hasn't exactly excelled itself over the last few years, but moving north into very poor rural areas, dry, arid areas of Chad and Niger, causing a lot of problems there. There's outbreaks of there are attacks on communities in those areas almost on a sort of daily or semi-weekly basis at the moment. Hundreds of thousands, probably about 150,000 refugees into those areas. At least 50,000 local villagers displaced. Dozens of people being killed. A very, very tragic situation, which isn't getting much publicity, but ironically, that is happening at the same time as sort of French forces have deployed across the region. So one doesn't want to go into a sort of cause and effect type argument at this stage because it's a bit more complex than that. But, you know, in fact, I read an article today questioning whether this intervention by the French really is not a failure altogether, both militarily and politically, because the situation across the region now is more of a mess than it has been really for at any time in the past. Very unstable, very insecure, very unclear, uncertain as to where things are heading, and not a very optimistic sort of scenario right across the entire region.
All right, y'all. Well, that is Jeremy Keenan. He is professorial research associate at the School of Oriental and Africa Studies at the University of London and the author of The Dark Sahara and The Dying Sahara. Find him at MiddleEastEye.net. The latest is Mali, a peace deal to promote conflict. Thanks very much, Jeremy. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Nice to talk with you.
And we'll be right back, y'all. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next is our friend Dan Sanchez. He teaches the Mises Academy at Mises.org, the Ludwig von Mises Institute there. They're more free market than you, than everyone. And he also writes for antiwar.com. It sounds like we got a bad connection here, though, dude. I'm going to hang up and call you right back, Dan.
Okay.
God, doesn't that sound terrible to everybody? I wonder if he's got a weird line or something. Got bad distortion on there.
All right.
Nah, that's also horrible. I'll tell you what, I'll call you. All right, y'all. So now I'm going to play a soundbite of some audio or another. Let me see. Here's Jimmy Carter toasting the Shah of Iran.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
All right, here's Michael Flynn talking about ISIS. Let me get Dan on the line here for you.
And a secret analysis by the agency you ran, the Defense Intelligence Agency, in August 2012 said, and I quote, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist, it's not secret anymore, was released under FOI. The quote is, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime. The US saw the ISIL caliphate coming and did not. Nothing. Did you see this document in 2012? Was this come across your table?
Yeah. I paid very close attention
okay.
to all this.
So when you
sure
saw
did.
This, did you not pick up a phone and saying, what on earth are
sure.
we doing supporting these Syrian rebels?
That kind of information is presented and
what did you
those
do about
become,
it?
Those become, I argued about it.
Did you say we shouldn't be supporting these groups?
I did. I mean, we argued about these, the different groups that were there, and we said, you know, who is it that is involved here? And I will tell you that I do believe that the intelligence was very clear. And now it's a matter of whether or not policy is going to be as clear and as defining and as precise as it needs to be. And I don't believe it was.
But in
2012,
which was
but
3 years ago, let's just be clear, just
right.
for the sake of our viewers. In 2012, your agency was saying, quote, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
In 2012, the U.S. was helping coordinate arms transfers to those same groups. Why did you not stop that if you're worried about the rise of, quote unquote,
yeah,
Islamic extremism?
I mean, I hate to say it's not my job, but that my job was to ensure that the accuracy of our intelligence.
What a great that is, Mehdi Hassan from Al Jazeera. Great credit to him. Great work there. Interviewing Michael Flynn, retired General Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, about that 2012 memo. But anyway, I'm sorry. I bet it's my Skype. I switched to Windows 10 and I think I stupidly broke the Skype somehow. Anyway, I got Dan on the telephone here. Dan Sanchez from Mises Academy at the Mises Institute there in Auburn, Alabama, and regular writer for antiwar.com and also, anti-media, which I guess is antimedia.com, right? Dan, welcome back.
Hi. Great. Yeah, antimedia.org, I believe.
.org, okay.
Theantimedia.org.
Theantimedia.org. Okay, good deal.
Yes.
All right, now, so brand new piece at antiwar.com, stop helping ISIS in its war on the gray zone. And then, even though it's the prequels, it is Star Wars, so you're kind of winning me over with your JPEG here, kid. You got my main man, Obi-Wan Kenobi, the guy who knows right from wrong better than anybody, I think. Trying to explain it to Anakin, who's going wrong. So explain it to me, Dan. What the hell is going on here?
Well, the great dialogue there is Anakin says, if you're not with me, then you're my enemy. And then Obi-Wan answers, only a Sith deals in absolutes. And that is often thought to be inspired by George W. Bush when, after 9/11, he said that if you're not with us, then you're with the terrorists. But actually, it was also seconded by none other than Osama bin Laden, that he said, the world today is divided into two camps. Bush spoke the truth when he said, either you are with us or you are with the terrorists, meaning either you are with the crusade or you are with Islam. And by Islam, he means the extremist Islam that he represents, that the Salafists like him consider non-extremists to be apostates and not true Muslims.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, how convenient for them. So now, you know, we could trace this back if you wanted. We could go back to 1993 and the beginning of Islam or Jihad's war, you know, basically Al-Qaeda's war against the United States then. But we all have seen the results ever really through the 90s and especially since September 11th. But now you're trying to say in this article that this is what the Islamic State is doing right now with this Paris attack?
That's right, because that Osama bin Laden quote was cited by an official ISIS publication called Dabiq, where they were saying that that development that both that bin Laden was addressing was a great development, and it's what they wanted. They called it the extinction of the gray zone. And so that by gray zone, they mean the gray area between, on one hand, what they call the Crusader camp and the camp of Islam. And so what they want is there to be no gray zone in between the two camps, that both camps to be warring against each other. And so they want both moderate Muslims to be driven towards the extremists, and so quote unquote fake Muslims to be exposed as tools of the Crusaders, and so they don't want anyone trying to make peace, anyone trying to coexist. They want the world to be just divided into just two warring camps, and so. What Juan Cole, an academic and journalist, believes, what he wrote after the Charlie Hebdo attacks back in January, he wrote that the strategy of these extremist groups is to what he called sharpen the contradictions. And so he likened it to a strategy of the communists, of certain communists, where they would do terrorist attacks in Europe, in Austria, in the early 20th century, in order to provoke police crackdowns on moderate leftists. And that was intended to drive those moderate leftists into revolutionary communism. And so Juan Cole believes that that's what groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda are trying to do, especially in France, because there is a large Muslim population in France, but they're not very political, especially not very politically Islamic. A lot of them are just very secular. And so the problem they're faced with is how to drive them into being radicalized. And so the strategy is to provoke a crackdown on Muslims in general, and then that will radicalize them. That is, so like you always say, the action is in the reaction, that that the terrorist attack itself is only phase one of the attack. Phase two is to elicit the police crackdown or the bombing, the war crackdown on Syria and Iraq and other Muslim countries, in order to radicalize Muslims and drive them into the extremist camp.
All right. Hang tight right there. It's Dan Sanchez from the Mises Academy and Antiwar.com. Stop helping ISIS in its war on the gray zone, he says, at Antiwar.com today. We'll be right back.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. On the line, I've got Dan Sanchez from the Mises Institute and antiwar.com. And yeah, the action and the reaction, Dan, I learned that from Will Grigg right after September 11th. He said, let's look at what the commies say about terrorism and what's the point. How does a weak actor, why does a weak group use terrorism against a strong group? What is the point? Just, I hate you and I'm throwing a temper tantrum? Or, I mean, obviously you're not winning a battlefield victory against an army division by setting off a bomb that kills civilians somewhere or whatever. So what is the damn point? And of course, the damn point is to get the victims to act when they're still mad and therefore dumb and hurt themselves. And all you got to do is just take one deep breath and stop and think about it for a minute. And the answer immediately should be not the George Bushian answer. Great, let's see how many different ways and to what extent we can exploit this. But how can we be smart and deny the terrorists the victory that they really seek, which is the reaction they want? You know, Robert Pape said on the show yesterday, they actually did deny Al-Qaeda the victory they wanted originally by not putting tens of thousands of troops on the ground in Afghanistan. Oh, but then they went and did 10 times worse in Iraq and so ended up, you know, doing, and then, of course, surging into Afghanistan and staying for 14 years and waging a whole separate war just like they did one after all. But originally, they went light and fast and all that. Just in a way to deny the terrorists what they wanted, at least in effect, maybe just because it took the military too long to get their ass in gear, and so they did it CIA style instead at first. But anyway, point being, this is what they're trying to do, is get the big, dumb American empire to destroy itself, and this is what the big, dumb American empire keeps doing. Oh, and as you're saying, trying to radicalize the people of the West against the Muslims who live in the West and try to make us believe that they are the alien enemies among us, when in fact they're no such thing.
That's right, and it's working. That's the terrible thing, is that as recent as the attacks were, you already, the Paris attacks were, you already see signs of, Juan Cole called it, you know, being beastly to Muslims. I mean, that's what the foreign policy of the West has been, being beastly to Muslims since the Afghan war. But it's also happening domestically, that there's signs of rising Islamophobia in both Europe and America following the attacks, and signs of crackdowns. They've already done a whole bunch of arrests and raids of suspects, and they're talking about dissolving mosques and even talking about interning what they call potential jihadists, the internment of potential jihadists. And like, how do you even, you know, determine that? How can you, you know, read someone's mind? It's all just a bunch of pre-crime. And what that's going to do is just end up with the persecution of Muslims just for being Muslims. And that's just a recipe for radicalization. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly what the terrorists want. And you see in America it seems even worse, because you have a lot of really ignorant people who have never met a Muslim in their lives, so their imagination can kind of run wild, and it's like a genocidal sentiment. I mean, you'll hear people on social media talking about just, you know, nuking them all, just wiping out all the Muslims as if they were just one undifferentiated camp, which is exactly, you know, what that whole eliminating the gray zone strategy is supposed to incite. Mm-hmm. And just thinking of just Islam as the enemy, never mind that it's a, you know, religion of the billion people that only a tiny, tiny minority is violent at all. And that it's Muslims that are fighting these extremists, that it's Muslims that are in Syria and Iraq that are trying to actually eliminate these extremists, but that just doesn't compute for them.
Well, and of course, as long as especially American cops believe the propaganda that it's Islam that makes them hate us, and that the clue to who is a threat and a terrorist is who's the most devout in their faith, you couldn't possibly hope for a more bin Ladenite friendly script there for the Americans to get caught up in. And of course, the alternative is admitting that this is because the Americans started it and that it's all about politics and war and real graveyards, and politics, power going on here. And they can't ever admit that. So as they're going to keep blaming Islam. And then so, assuming the fake premise, what's an American cop supposed to do? Except monitor those who seem to really make sure to pray five times a day. I mean, that guy, he must be a real terrorist nut, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And that's the completely warped lens that they're looking at it through. And in fact, you see, like, what just happened in France, I assume, they have the same problem as us. Their cops are busy spying on everyone instead of the guy who said he's going to do this. They're not watching him, you know?
Right. Right. And that's another big development following the attack, is that you can see just in the mainstream media, just this concerted push of trying to push for encryption, banning encryption, right? I'm sorry, and they're trying to make the case that Snowden has blood on his hands, that the reason why this attack was able to go through was because the intelligence agencies don't have the tools necessary, and so what they try to say is that it's because of encryption, because of Snowden revealing the tools that agencies have, that it made the terrorists like go underground and avoid calls that could be tapped and messages that could be intercepted. When that's ridiculous, as Glenn Greenwald points out, that terrorists have known from way before Snowden did the leak that the government was able to listen in on their calls and to intercept their messages. And so way before the leaks, they've been aware of that. Someone made a joke that even the drug dealers on the wire knew not to use a cell phone. And so it has nothing to do with that. But what the mainstream media is just uncritically just publishing these anonymous leaks from American officials saying that the Snowden revelations had a negative impact without any proof, without any evidence, and the mainstream media just regurgitates that without even questioning.
Come on, Dan. Your freedom has been motivating and aiding and abetting these terrorists all along. When are you going to stop?
Right. And like you say, that like what Snowden said in one of his interviews is that, you know, that mass surveillance is making it harder for them to prevent attacks like this, because they're so focused on getting the whole haystack, they call it, and just, you know, mass monitoring everyone, that the resources devoted to that cannot be devoted to actual, you know, detective work and actual, you know, tracking actual threats.
Right.
And the actual threats are just getting lost in the cacophony of data that they have.
Yep. Yep. And just like the FBI, you know, you could have guessed, I had guessed and said in more general terms, but then it turned out that literally the Boston FBI was in the middle of entrapping some dumbass while the Marathon plot was being put together right under their noses. You know, these are the people we put in charge of keeping us safe and of determining who the enemy is. And so listen, here's the thing about it, everybody. I'm sorry. I'm very clumsy and doing a bad job today. But Dan has done a great job in this article. I hope you'll go and look at it. It's called Stop Helping ISIS in Its War on the Gray Zone. And it's about how America's hawks are doing our enemies dirty work for them. And, I might add the corollary, whatever, that I think this audience will all agree with. Now's a good time to, embrace Muslims in your community and let them know that you value religious freedom and their, you know, lives and freedom as well and whatever, and not let the hawks on either side take advantage of us civilized people in the middle. So thanks again, Dan. Really appreciate your time on the show, dude.
You're welcome. Great to be on. Thank you.
All right, y'all. That is the great Dan Sanchez. He is at the Mises Institute and antiwar.com. How do you like that? This one is called Stop Helping ISIS in Its War on the Gray Zone. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott here. The thing is, I need you guys to help me to get these download numbers up. So do me a favor and sign up for the podcast feeds of this show. You can choose the whole show or just the interviews at iTunes and Stitcher. All the buttons you need are at the top of the right margin at scotthorton.org. The more subscribers I have, the more iTunes and Stitcher will help promote the show to new listeners. If you're a hardcore fan, brand new or from way back, please leave them customer ratings and reviews, too. I'm trying to get these wars ended. All right, guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I want to tell you about this new book, this new advertiser on the show. I'd probably want to talk with you about it anyway, I think. The book is called Immigration, Individual versus National Borders. It's by David Hathaway. And it's only $3.60 for the paperback right now on Amazon.com, and the Kindle's $1. And I wrote the foreword to it. Immigration, Individual versus National Borders. And here's what the book is. The guy is an Austrian school student, at least. And he argues praxeology. For those of you who are not Austro-libertarians or don't know about it, that's basically the theory of human action developed by the Austrian school that starts with the premise that human beings are individuals, and from there, they act, at least according to what they believe to be in their best interests, on different time scales and subject to considerations, of course. But that's where Austrian economics comes from, the premise that human beings are individuals and that they have preferences and will behave in ways to coincide with those preferences. And from there, it's a logical argument, beginning to end. And so there's a phenomenon in Austrian school libertarianism that says we should be closed borders, and that open borders is a big government status policy, and closed borders is the limited government policy. And that if we did have a private property anarchy, which we should have, that it would be a very restrictionist, anti-immigration kind of a place, and that we should insist our government act like that until the day, or something. And anyway, I admit that I have not read all of this material for the immigration restrictions by the Austrian economists, but David Hathaway sure has, and he has addressed them all. And he has addressed them all in an Austrian school economics kind of way. And he's not naming names and trashing people. He's just, you know, trying his best, I think fairly, to sum up their arguments and then show why they're wrong from an Austrian point of view. From an Austrian school economics point of view. Which may or may not have a damn thing to do with the nation of Austria today. I don't know. I guess they probably must have Austrian school economists in Austria now, right? For a while there, they just had Nazis and commies. Maybe they're back to got a school somewhere there. Anyway, right now the Austrian school's in Alabama. How you like that? Sort of. Mostly. Anyway, David Hathaway. Immigration, Individual versus National Borders. It's now on sale at Amazon.com. The foreword is by me. And if you're a libertarian and you're interested in this argument, I highly suggest that you buy this book. I think that you'll dig it. I think he did a great job on it, man. I really do. And that's why I was happy to write the foreword to it. And I'll tell you this, too. Kind of interesting. The guy that wrote it, David Hathaway, is a former DEA agent and apparently a supervisor. He must have been a horrible person. I don't know. He seems nice. And he's a regular writer for LouRockwell.com. And my favorite, he wrote a piece about the Oklahoma City bombing one time that I think you might want to look at. Here's a guy who was in the DEA at the time, and you know all these federal cops. They all know each other and what's going on there, man. Know a guy who knows a guy who knows the deal. PatCon, that was the FBI's operation. There was an ATF investigation, an FBI investigation, a Patriot conspiracy. That was what they named it. And these were the guys what set up the Oklahoma City bombing that killed 180 people, 89 people. It's a horrible massacre. It was such a big deal. I don't know if you guys remember back 95, but the trauma from that thing was, you can't say it was like 9/11 mini or something. It was like 9/11, man. It was just as traumatic as could be. Almost 200 people blasted. And all pinned on one guy whose closest accomplice was two states away at the time. What a convincing narrative. What's that you say? O.J. Simpson killed his wife? Why, I think I'll pay attention to that instead. The American people decided. So they executed one and imprisoned the other, and then that was it. Except the real story, and it's been known all these years because especially the heroic late J.D. Cash, my friend from the McCurtain Gazette there, and a lot of other great journalists, including, what's his name from the Telegraph? The guy that wrote The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Ambrose Evans Pritchard wrote a great thing about it. Anyway, yeah, man, it was the government what did that. I think mostly it was an accident. I think mostly it was supposed to be a sting and then it went wrong. I think that actually is the most plausible explanation. Not that the whole thing was just a false flag. But, you know, just like 9/11, they exploited it so horribly and cynically that makes no difference, really. They might as well have done it. Bill Clinton even said, "The Oklahoma City bombing saved my presidency." Yeah, the whole country rallied around their leader, me, against the forces of right-wing hate and blah-da-blah. And he got that right, too. That's right. It did. Because that's how badly he exploited at the time. Passed the first Patriot Act. Well, not the very first one. Called Patriot Act 3.0 before we got hit by 4.0. I don't know. J. Edgar Hoover had some Patriot Acts of his own, didn't he? But anyway, the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that they got on their reaction. And you know what I really hate about the Oklahoma bombing that the government did? Is that it became the excuse for the Waco massacre after the fact. When the laws of logic and time and physics forbid such a thing. The Branch Davidians did not get in a time machine and go forward in time and do the Oklahoma City bombing, somehow justifying what happened to them. And it wasn't Branch Davidian survivors that did it either. And the government sock puppets that were put up to do it may have invoked Waco, but so? All they proved was it's horrible when people are massacred. How in the world does one justify the other? And I know, because I've heard it a million times. Oh yeah, well what about Oklahoma City? You can't talk about Waco. Well, what about Oklahoma City? Well, what about Oklahoma City? Justifies what happened to Waco. You're just saying that somebody who sympathized with them got more than payback, and so shut up? Or you're saying the Davidians really deserved it because of how horrible the Oklahoma bombing was 2 years later? It doesn't have to make any sense at all. It's called statism. It's a religion. Hey, look, I love me some cops no matter what. The ATF is nothing but a bunch of drunken rapists who got kicked off of every sheriff's department where they came from. Who shoot women and children in their homes on a Sunday morning. Whatever, I love them. Whatever they did is right. Whatever I need to invoke to somehow justify what these people do to us. Anyway, read Hathaway on that. It's good. LouRockwell.com, he wrote about that. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And I'm going to switch to Syria in just a sec, but let me say real quick about Oklahoma City. I know it sounds like crazy, whatever crap, if you've never heard that before, oh, Scott's Oklahoma truther or whatever. But there's a great book by Gumbel and Charles, my friend Roger Charles, called Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Matters. And it's not the full everything story. I think the guy Gumbel really took control and sort of let me down in a few ways. But it doesn't really matter, because the point of it is that it's mainstream, legit journalism. It's not a bunch of hokum. It's not Bill Gertz from the Washington Times off on some crap. It's good journalism about who the guys were who helped McVeigh do it and the extent of their involvement. Well, better to say, the extent of the government's involvement, the ATF and the FBI's involvement with these Nazis before they did what they did, and their infiltration and the sting operation and the, you know, PatCon and all this stuff. And it's in the book where they have quotes, and it's like a quadruple negative or whatever. I can't not say that if we had not, maybe negative forward this, that, backwards doubled that, we decided that it would jeopardize McVeigh's death penalty prosecution if we continued to investigate to see who else may have been involved. Because if we admitted it was a larger conspiracy, then we could be creating reason for doubt that he was involved or even very involved, and we really wanted to execute McVeigh. And so the decision was made to stop the investigation and to not seek, not hold accountable any of the other people involved. And of course, mostly this is really to protect themselves for what they knew and when. Is of course the biggest part of it. But they admit that. That's the actual federal prosecutor admits. You know what he says is like, I could not say that if you held a show of hands, if any of us did not think that maybe there were others that we did, you know, it was like one of these. Yeah. What he's trying to say very simply is we decided to not prosecute everyone responsible for a massacre of 189 people for political reasons. And he admits it. And it's in the book. And there's an interview, especially if you're a liberal Democrat, realist type and you're into the reality-based community and you don't like a bunch of hype and a bunch of right-wing propaganda, well, then I will urge you to go and look at Peter Bergen's interview of Andrew Gumbel at the New America Foundation. You know, Anne-Marie Slaughter and Stephen Clemens. The New America Foundation, a very center-left think tank in Washington, D.C. And there's Peter Bergen, the CNN terrorism expert, one of the men who interviewed Osama bin Laden in 1996 in Afghanistan. And he interviews Gumbel and he explains it was the Nazis what did it and the FBI knew all about it and it still happened anyway. Go figure that. And it's right there on YouTube. You just got to put in Gumbel, like Brian Gumbel, only it's Andrew Gumbel. Gumbel, Bergen, Oklahoma City, and it'll come right up on your YouTube results there in Google, okay? So I'm not a kook. Really, that many people died, and really, the feds let the murderers get away with it, and because they were in on it. And I'm sorry, but it's true. Okay. Now, Syria. I've been telling you for 4.5 years that it is a very wrong move for our government. Not just it's immoral or whatever, but in the scheme of things, it is really a bad idea for our government to be backing the veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Sunni jihadists who killed 4,500 Americans. Well, I guess the Shia probably killed 500 of them, the Sadrists. But 4,000 Americans died at the hands of the Sunni-based insurgency. And a good part of that was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi's guys. And anyone who was a Libyan or a Syrian who traveled to Iraq to fight against the Americans that whole time under Bush, they would have said, and I think pretty much correctly, that these guys are Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who, when the foreigners come, when the foreign fighters come, that's who they fall in with. The Jordanian-led, Zarqawi-led Al-Qaeda in Iraq group, which was tolerated by the Sunni tribes back then, in the size they were then, in order to help fight the Americans. And I've been saying that, holy crap, Obama, and not just, I've been saying this because I know this because I interview the best reporters in the world all the time, that's all. I mean, every single day, right? So that's how I know. It's not because I speak Arabic or anything. Hey, look, the Libyan rebels are the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. They are veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they are. And Obama's got us taking their side in Libya. And then as soon as it all started spreading to Syria, we've been covering that too. This whole time since the spring and summer of 2011, NATO's intervention against Syria. And by December, Phil Giraldi had a piece in antiwar.com saying there are two new findings, one against Iran and one against Syria, stepping up covert action. And that means support for the rebels in Syria. That was by December 2011. But in the spring and summer, we had reports from Patrick Coburn and from Eric Margolies and from Pepe Escobar and the Libyans. In fact, it was even in the Sunday Times of London, I think, in the summer 2011. Big ship full of guns and jihadists on its way to land it in Turkey. And the fight was between who's going to get it, the Muslim Brotherhood or the Al-Qaeda guys. And from the very beginning, I've been saying, what do you think's going to happen? when in the future, when all this just blows back. You think Iraq War II was bad and turning all of Western Iraq into Jihadistan for 10 years. What about this? What about backing them and spreading their war into Libya and all into the center of North Africa and into Syria, into the Levant, and then for years on end, I've been saying, and look at all the Europeans and even Americans who are going to Syria to fight on the side of the jihadists. What do you think's going to happen when they come home? In fact, for that matter, I've been saying since 2000, for 10 years, what do you think's going to happen when all the Libyans and Syrians and everybody goes home? Well, I didn't anticipate Obama was going to take their side, but I did think they'd be trouble. And that part was certainly right. And now, and I'm not just saying this is how smart I am, guys. I'm trying to make a larger point here about what the hell is going on here. That there are at least hundreds, maybe, I guess, thousands of Europeans who have gone to Syria to fight with the jihadists. Not 100% of whom are terrorists now, who are going to attack targets in, you know, back in their home countries. But some of them are. And some of them are going to have gone to, will have gone to Syria and back without that being known. They will have gotten away with it secretly. I was just visiting my auntie in Turkey, they said. And they will be able to get in the United States at some point. Our government has, if George Bush's blunder in invading Iraq benefited the jihadists who thrived in Anbar and in northwestern Iraq, then what Obama did is just quadrupled down on that error. And quite deliberately, I'm not saying, oh, it was some innocent mistake of his. But now we got a real problem, because when all those refugees are coming north, there are, and I'm not trying to demonize refugees, they're the victims here. But there are going to be sleepers among them. And I've already seen pictures, and I don't know, you know, maybe some of this is overblown, but I've seen pictures of guys who, here they are, there's the Islamic State, and here sure looks like the same couple of guys to me, only now they're on a train platform somewhere in Hungary or something. And so there could be people getting deep behind European lines right now in order to wage attacks, and I think it's going to happen in the U.S. too. And I'm not trying to scaremonger. And I am a broken record about this. I've been saying this for years and years on end. And I'm not scaremongering and saying that this is a war that, you know, this is why we got to fight them. I'm saying this is why we should not be fighting them or backing them. For God's sake, we shouldn't be backing them. But I'm against joining with Russia and Iran and Syria against the Islamic State or al-Nusra or anything. America should just completely butt out. At this point, we have to just call it quits. We don't have a single leader in America going to walk that tightrope that Robert Pape talked about on the show yesterday, that where this could be done right. All we have is Bushes and Clintons. We've got to stop.